Who taught you? Where have you picked up this knowledge? Does the fact that you don't know every jot and every tittle change it? You know, we understand that the power invested in the whomever, the rights that we are given by those legal documents that formed our country and so on and so forth, are those things which govern our existence. We've probably been pulled over in a traffic stop somewhere and say, or in uttered words, "Oh, officer, I didn't know," to which he replied, "Ignorance of the law is no excuse," right? Or something similar. Or we've all heard someone who has. Does it make it any less binding on us simply because we weren't there and didn't see it happen? Do we believe it any less simply because we weren't there when Jefferson and Madison and whomever else, Hancock and list off the people and Franklin and so on and so forth? Does that make it any less real? What about these crazy Israelites? What were they getting? What had they not had before? A law. Written in stone, literally. Where are we now as they're physically around the mountain? What are they seeing? What visual do they have in front of them? We talked about it last week. There's smoke, there's thunder, there's lightning, there's fire, there's the earth quaking. Would you have a tendency to believe that the word that you were being given was holy, was complete, was full, was accurate, was something that you needed to live by if you were there and saw it? Does it make a difference if you weren't there? It certainly does not. Is the law any less or more binding on us because we weren't there in 1776? No. Do we have any excuses for violating any of those things because we weren't there in 1776? No. But if you had been there, what would have been fresh on your mind? And what do you think was fresh on the Israelites' mind? Because in chapter 22, where we're starting today, where are they? Physically, they're around the mountain. We looked last week at the scripture that indicated they saw all of these things. God is speaking either directly to them or He's speaking to Moses, who is speaking directly to the Israelites. And the word is being given, and this is before Moses ever goes up on the mountaintop. God came to Moses in chapter 18 and said, "Get all the people ready. Third day from now, I'm going to have a conversation." So there's 3 days that they knew that something special was happening. Then we've got whatever time there was that God presented to them all these visual effects as Moses got ready to go up on the mountain, and then Moses went up on the mountain. And he was there 40 days and 40 nights. And what happened while he was up there? They forgot everything, didn't they? Can you imagine? Why? How? A month ago, you stood by a mountain, you felt the ground shake, you saw the fire, you saw the smoke, you heard thunders, and yet you forgot. Amazing. These things that we're looking at last week and this week, and we're going to get Moses up on the mountain this week, are those things which God gave them word of before, and as we'll get to, during on the mountain, etc., and so on. Speaking of that too, by the way, the new quarter starts on first Sunday in February, and it says on the thing we're going to be studying Leviticus. Well, remember I told you when we started we were going to spend a whole lot more time on Exodus than we were Leviticus. We will not finish Exodus in the next 2 weeks. We will continue Exodus as we go into the next quarter, and we'll get to Leviticus. All right? Chapter 22, the laws regarding property. What generally happens if somebody steals your stuff? Bill says you don't have it anymore. Bill, go deeper for me. What happens to the person typically? What remedy is required to that person who stole your stuff? Restitution. How much restitution did you have to pay for an ox if you stole it? 22:1. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 for a sheep. Sheep were worth a little less than oxen. Not sure why. Maybe it's the size. Maybe it's the ability to do the work they did. The oxen was more important to the family for being able to do those things which sustained their family. But that was the rule. Verse 2 is something I found particularly interesting. Verse 2 and 3. What happens if you catch someone breaking into your house? What? Now wait a minute, Chuck. Does this say that you can kill them? That you are obligated to kill them? Now be careful. No. What it says was, if you catch someone breaking into your house and they die because of that event, there is a scuffle, there is action taken, then is there any guilt on the part of the homeowner? There is not. Right then, there, at that particular moment in time, when you caught that person stealing your stuff. What happens if they get away and the next morning the sun has risen on him? Verse 3 is a little different. Okay, we've got to be careful how we read it. Look carefully. Starting with verse 2. If the thief is found breaking in and he is struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. If the sun has risen on him, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed. What is that telling you? Pardon? Yeah, but think about it in context. You caught him in the act. Something happened. You caught him in the act and he gets away. Or he gets away without necessarily you catching him in the act. Can you go chase him down and apply that same penalty that you would have applied if you caught him in your house? And that's what we're talking about. Okay? So, I come home. Dan Fuller is in my house taking my big screen TV. I'm not going to put up with it. I shoot Dan Fuller and kill him right there on the spot. What's happened? Am I guilty of the bloodshed?
No.
Dan Fuller escapes from my house with my big screen television. I go chase him down. I find him and I kill him. Different situation. Okay? Are we seeing current laws mirror that? You know, with castle doctrines and so on and so forth? Yeah, in your house. Does that give you the right and does it give you the right to go act as in vengeance, as your own posse comitatus, and go chase the person down?
No, because that is,
and absolutely,
premeditated.
Yes, absolutely does not. Now he's still guilty of stealing something, making full restitution. If he has nothing, then what's the remedy? He has to be sold. All right. It's his responsibility. He's got to fix it one way or the other, whether he has the item, whether he gets the item back, or whether or not he has to himself be punished by becoming a slave. If the theft is certainly found alive in his hands, whether it is an ox or a donkey, he shall restore double. Okay? Remember, if he stole it, there was and something happened to it, he had to restore it 5. If he steals it, you find it, you still got to pay it back, but you got to get an extra. One more. Verse 7. If a man delivers to his neighbor money or articles to keep, and it is stolen out of the man's house, if the thief is found, he shall pay double. We just got through reading that. If the thief is not found, then the master of the house shall be brought to the judges to see whether or not he put his hands into his neighbor's cookie jar. Interesting, isn't it? You steal something. You loan something. That disappears. No, it wasn't me. I'm not the one that took it. Thief got it. An investigation takes place. Is the thief found? Thief is not found. Then who has to go before the judges and get grilled, questioned? The man you loaned it to. All right? He's got to face the questions to make sure that he wasn't a part of it. Verse 9, for any kind of trespass, ox, donkey, sheep, clothing, etc., the cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whoever the judges condemns shall pay double to his neighbor. All right? So there was a responsibility to act properly with your own property, with your neighbor's property, to act in a civil way in all circumstances. Verse 10, if a man delivers to his neighbor a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal, and it dies, and it or is hurt, or it is driven away, and no one sees it, verse 11, then an oath of the Lord shall be between them both, and he has not put his hand into his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept that, and he shall not make it good. So I loaned Dan Fuller my power washer. My power washer disappears. Dan Fuller doesn't know what happens to it because it was out in the garage. And Dan doesn't sleep in the garage most nights with the power washer. He's going to give me an affidavit saying, don't know what happened to the power washer. What's my responsibility? Accept it, face value. Is my neighbor, is my brother going to lie to me? No. Okay. 12. But if in fact it is stolen from him, he shall make restitution to the owner of it. I'm sorry, wait a minute. Owner of it shall accept that. He shall not make good. But if in fact it is stolen from him, then he shall make restitution to the owner of it. If it is torn to pieces by a beast, he shall bring it as evidence, and he shall not make good what was torn. And if a man borrows anything and it becomes injured or dies, the owner of it not being with it, he surely shall make it good. Now, if I take my power washer over to Dan's house and I do his driveway and it breaks while I'm with my own power washer doing Dan's driveway, it's not Dan's fault. Okay? Does all this make sense? Is it anything... Isn't it just common sense of how things should work amongst brothers and amongst people and amongst mankind? I think so too. God makes it evident as to exactly what's going to happen though. Verse 16 are questions about the laws regarding our responsibilities for property. Verse 16 has to do with moral and ceremonial principles. Look at verse 18. What does it say? Kill the sorceress. We're not there yet, but there's a lot of instruction in law regarding witches, sorcerers, and so on and so forth. You know, it was not to be practiced. It was not to be something that you took part in. And although this is not as specific as some of the other laws that we see later, it's pretty clear. Kill the sorceress. You shall not permit the sorceress to live. Of course, there's laws concerning bestiality and so on and so forth. Verse 20, he who sacrificed to any god except to the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed. What are the Israelites going to do in just a little bit over a month's time. There's that crazy old golden calf. Man, here it is. This is the law. It's right here. He who sacrifices to any god except to the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed. Verse 21. Look at verse 21. This is going to come up here and again and in several more places, actually. You shall neither mistreat a stranger nor oppress him. Why? What's the rest of that verse? For you were once strangers in Egypt. What does God intend for the Israelites not to forget? Where they were, where they came from, what they did, how they left, and under whose authority they left. Never forget where you came from. You were strangers. Now, the prevailing attitude of today sometimes is, don't forget who did something to you and go back and do it worse to them. Is that what God says here? You were a stranger. You weren't treated well. How do I expect you to treat strangers? You're a better person. You're going to do it differently. You're going to treat them with respect because you've been in their shoes before. Vast difference in how God gave it to them and sometimes how we as a society interpret it today. Verse 22, what do we do with the widows and the orphans? How do we treat the widows and the orphans? We care for them. Now, verse 23 is pretty interesting because if you afflict the widows and the orphans in any way, they will cry out to me, God will hear their call, and my wrath will become hot, and I will kill you with a sword. It's a capital offense to mistreat the widows and the orphans. How, as a church, do we take care of our orphans? What was one of the first complaints that came up in the first century with the church amongst the believers, the Christians? The Grecian widows, right? Had to be taken care of. What were they complying with in doing that? Back to the Constitution. Back to 1776 or whatever. Back to day one. This was what God had instructed them to do. Take care of those widows, take care of those orphans, because who do they have to take care of them? Individuals? No. The group? Yes. Yes. Exodus chapter 22. Verse 25. If you lend money to any of my people who are poor amongst you, you shall not be like a money lender to him. You shall not charge him interest. What's the restriction there? To someone who is what? Pardon? Your people, but there's another restriction to it. Poor. We're talking about loaning money amongst the Israelites. Secondly, we're talking about loaning money to those that are poor. So, hey Greg, how you doing? You don't go to church here anymore. You got lost? If I loan money to Greg because I know Greg has a ton of it, is it okay to charge him interest? Greg's got more money than Fort Knox. Can I charge him interest? All right, yes. Now, I decide that I want to loan money to Kevin Weeks. I happen to know that Kevin Weeks doesn't have two nickels to rub together. Is it okay to charge Kevin interest on that short-term loan so that he can get his electricity turned back on? All right. No, it's not. What's God trying to illustrate here with these rules amongst those brothers? You treat your brothers differently. You take care of your brothers. You take care of your family. You take care of those that are with you in God. Is it any different today? No, I don't think so. Verse 28, you shall not revile your God, nor curse a ruler of your people. Has anybody ever said anything bad about a ruler of our people? And I'm not talking about necessarily today. I'm talking about over your lifetime. Because who has taken from one time or another the brunt of anger from at least half of the people that are under subjection to that particular government? You know, has there ever been any ruler that we've had in your lifetime that's been elected with a 100% vote? So somebody didn't vote for that person. And if the person's in there that you didn't vote for, have you ever got mad at them and talked bad about them? Well, what does that say? Was that wrong or right? Do not curse a ruler. Remember Romans 13 too. What government is put in place with God's blessing? All of them. I think I've talked about this before. If I have, fine, I'll just do it again. You get older, you forget stuff. You know, you repeat yourself a lot. You know, you just expect everybody else to go with the flow and not fuss at you about it. But it was really hard when I went to Russia to explain to those people that the government that had been in place for 70 years was okay by God. Because that government had told those people, there is no God. How did you get that across? How did you get Romans 13 across to those people? It wasn't easy. But without the government, even that government, what would there have been? Chaos. All right. Verse 29, give your first fruits. You shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe produce and your juices. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. What? How we do that? What is the reference to here regarding those? First, well, let me back up. What is our attitude to be towards giving God those things that we give God? What do we give God? What does first fruits mean? It means the first and the best. Okay? It's what you would pull off the vine to keep for yourself first. You know, and then give everybody else what was left over? No, you give it to God first. How does that relate to your firstborn? What had the Israelites just gone through as they left Egypt? How did they redeem their firstborn? Because God was going to take which firstborns when He went through Egypt? All right, keep that part in mind. Remember, some of the plagues had been split and were applicable only to the Egyptians and not to the Jews. Okay? We had the cattle dying, for example, was one that just pops into my head. There were others that were Egyptian plagues only. When we get to the 10th plague, when we get to the death of the firstborn, if you didn't have the blood on your doorpost, what was going to happen? Everybody. There was a redemption process there. You were redeeming your firstborn with the blood of the Lamb. Sound familiar? Let me get to imagery. All right. Firstborn belongs to God. Does it continue to belong to God? It does. Okay. There is a redemption process. All the things that you're going to sacrifice to me are going to redeem that firstborn for you. But that firstborn, figuratively, literally, belongs to who? God. Look in chapter 34 of Exodus, verse 20. Firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb, and if you will not redeem him, then you shall break his neck. All the firstborn of your sons you shall redeem, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. How did they redeem? What did they do? Pardon? There was an offering made. There was a sacrifice made. Again, back to the first fruits. You're giving to God special things, that which is first and foremost, and you're presenting that to God to recognize to Him that you understand the redemption process, that all things belong to God. Well, do they still all belong to God? Do we go through a redemption process when our first child is born? Do we have a baby, come down here to church, build an altar, make a sacrifice, send up something? No. How do we redeem that firstborn? How do we redeem ourselves? What is God trying to teach us here with the importance of everything that is best and first? How many of you have more than one child? Several. Is there anything special about the first? Now, I'm the only one, okay? So there's something special about me, obviously. But is there something special about the firstborn child? How do you treat a firstborn child as a parent? Do you hover a bit until you get it right with either the second or the third one, or the fourth one, or the fifth one, or whatever? I don't know. Do you have a question?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, you know, everything our learning experience was present on
her. Absolutely. We make all the mistakes with the firstborn, and then hopefully we get a little bit better.
But then they will be able to learn all that we've learned and pass it down.
We hope. I think as parents, and this is kind of, I guess we're getting off the subject a little bit, but it took me a long time to figure out that the old adage was, you've heard parents say, do what I say, not what I do. That's just wrong. Because what are our kids going to do? They're going to do what we do. God's going to be important to them. God better be important to us. That's the bottom line of this whole thing. Chapter 23. Look at verse 2. Do not follow a crowd to do evil. Mob mentality. Warning against that even then. What happens when you get with a group of people? You kind of lose that ability to have good sense sometimes. You go with the flow. You get caught up in it. And you take actions that you wouldn't otherwise take. Do not follow a crowd to do evil. Number 5, verse 5, chapter 23. If you see a donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, and you refrain from helping it, you're doing wrong. I should have gone back to verse 4. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall take it back to him. How do we act sometimes when we see bad things happening to our enemy? Yeah. He deserves it. No, he doesn't deserve it. Being a Christian means we're treating him just the same we treat anyone else. And remember the stranger thing? You know, we've already been told once, you were a stranger, treat strangers properly. Treat your enemies properly. Go down to verse 9. Also, you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Then we've got some laws that have to do with the Sabbath. Those laws that have to do with the Sabbath over a period of time will be greatly blown out of proportion. I guess, is the best way of putting it. But yet they're there. And there are three feasts that God calls for. Okay, starting in verse 14. Passover, Pentecost, and Atonement. Those three times were given to the Israelites to be special. There are others, and there will be others, that have other significance. But these three, one Passover, and that's the big one, and we know what that had to do with. We were just there a few weeks ago earlier in Exodus. Pentecost, or the Feast of Harvest, and then the Feast of Atonement, or the Feast of the Ingathering. It's what we now refer to in today's time as Yom Kippur. So those three feasts were given for the Israelites to remember everything that God gave them. In verse, there's a rather curious verse, chapter 23, verse 19. The first of the first fruits, again, with reference. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. I just throw this in kind of as a sidebar. That could mean a reference to that actual event of boiling a young goat in his mother's milk. That was an Arab custom at one time. It also could simply be a euphemism for don't take the baby away from the mom immediately upon birth. And if you'll go back to chapter 22, verse 30, likewise you shall do with your oxen and your sheep. It shall be with its mother 7 days. On the eighth day you shall give it to me. There's nothing biologically special about the eighth day regarding sheep or oxen. But we do see the number 7 used over and over and over again, right? You know, 7, 10, 40, that kind of thing. Certain numbers that seem to have more significance. Just, I don't know how important that chapter 23, verse 19 is, but just throwing that out there. Verse 23. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the Amorites and the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. Pretty much listing everybody, and we need to remember as we go through all the different places the Israelites went through, the listing is given here. These are the people that you're going to wipe out. Do not go with them. Do not bow down to their gods or serve them, nor do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and completely break down their sacred pillars. What do we know that the Israelites have constant problem with all throughout their history? The gods of the people in whose land they are. The Baals, the Asherahs, all these kind of things. God makes it clear, you shouldn't be going there. Verse 32, you shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. Verse 28 is interesting, how God's going to do some of this. I will send hornets before you, which will drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite. I will not drive them out before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the feast of the and the beast of the field. I'm sorry, the beast of the beast of the field become too numerous for you. Is there anything that God has not thought of? If you go in and if He wipes out everything with hornets ahead of time, then what's going to come in behind the hornets? Lions and tigers, oh my. You know, is there anything that He hadn't figured out ahead of time? No. I'm going to do this. I'm going to put this in your hands. I'm going to give you exactly the right timing to take care of it. Now go do it. Verse chapter 24. This is what's important here. Who agrees to all of this? If you have a heading in your Bible in chapter 24, what does it say above it? Mosaic covenant ratified. Say it again.
Mosaic covenant ratified.
Mosaic covenant ratified. Mine says Israel affirms the covenant. What did Israel do around the mountain as God gave them all this instruction? What did they say? Verse 3. So Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, "We ain't going to do it." No, they did not say that. "All the words which the Lord has said, we will do." Did they? Or did they have a problem? Verse 7. Then Moses took the book of covenant and read in the hearing of the people. Remember, all these things Moses has written. Okay? This is the book. Remember when we see the kings finding the book? Was it Josiah that found the book? Here's the book. Okay, Moses wrote the book. The first part of the book. Verse 7. Then he took the book of the covenant. He read in the hearing of the people, and they said, "All that the Lord has said, we will do, and we will be obedient." Were they? Some of the time? Most of the time not. Verse 10. And they saw the God of Israel, and there was under His feet as it were a paved work of sapphire and stone, and it was like the very heavens in its clarity. Moses, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, Joshua, and several of the others were allowed to come close enough, not go to the mountaintop with Moses, but come there and see the glory of God. That's what they saw in verse 10. The glory of God. What was it like? This is how they described it. Paved work of sapphire stone. And it was like the very heavens in its clarity. Should there have been any doubt as to who was on the mountain? Should there have been any doubt as to what their job was? Verse 12. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you tablets of stone and the law and the commandments which I have written, that you may teach them." So Moses arose with his assistants. Moses arose with his assistant, singular, not plural, Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. And he said to the elders, "Wait here for us until we come back to you. Indeed, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man has a difficulty, let him go to them." Did the people go to Aaron with what they perceived to be a difficulty? We're getting into next week's lesson just a little bit. But what was the difficulty that they had when they went to Aaron? Pardon?
Moses is not coming back.
All right, Jim is exactly correct in his response, because their problem was they came to Aaron and they said, "We lost Moses. We don't know where he is. He's not coming back. He's on the mountain. The mountain is in smoke and fire. Where did Moses say he was going? He said he was going on the mountain. He said he was going with God. Guess who went up part way with him to confirm? Aaron, Nadab, Abihu. Why did God call a few up to the mountain instead of just Moses? Was Joshua there too? I can't speak for God, but does it not make sense that when Moses and several of these people went part way up and they saw all this glory, and then Moses went forward and the others went back, the others could confirm to everybody else, "Look, he's really up there"? I get so frustrated when I think about these things. And yet, what do we do today as a society? Do we remember all these great things that have been done for us in the past and have faith that they will continue to be done for us in the future? I think not. I think not. Sometimes it's a struggle for us. Sometimes it's a struggle for me too. I don't mean that I'm talking down to anybody. I'm preaching to myself as much as I am teaching the class. Questions or comments? Richard? Richard's point is excellent. Who's the leader of the Israelites? Moses. Who's giving the law? God. When we go to Egypt, who gave the law? Pharaoh. All right? His point is that when we get into these other nations and countries and kingdoms and so on and so forth, man gave the law. Regarding the Israelites, who gave the law? God gave the law. He gave it through Moses, but God wrote it. All right. Questions, comments, real quick. I know the bell's rung, etc., and we're supposed to stop. All right. We'll start with 25 next week. Moses is on the mountain, and we'll try to get through that period of time when he was up there on the mountain and go through those things that God gave him.